okay? So I decided to go from here to drive the Hamiltonian formalism. And I haven't left myself much room, but I may have to continue over there. But I promise you, it's just a few steps. Now, remember that the manifold, we now take the space-time manifold as time running, so the manifold is of the form of some three manifold cross R. Time runs in the R direction, and we have some coordinates xi in the spatial manifold. And if I write out what this is, the important thing for finding the Hamiltonian formalism is to see where the time derivatives go. So this is a wedge. So a wedge in space-time is a 0, 1, and a 2, 3. It's symmetric in I and J, so it doesn't matter where I put the 0, 1, and the 2, 3. So this is like the integral, and there's an epsilon ijk. There's really a 0 ijk, but that's the same thing because it says ijk are spatial indices that have to be different from each other. And there is here f0i, and f0i is del 0 a I, and unfortunately, I'm using the same kind of indices. So what are we going to do about that? Let me put little lines under these indices. Okay, because I won't be using them too much. A, I think I probably used capital I in previous.
Yeah. Sort of having to be running
earlier. So far I only use the I and J for the frame field indices. Okay, so here's the first time I'm using them.
Or you can label them A, B, C.
No, because I'm already using A, B, C. I don't know, but does anybody have a preference?
You use capital I.
Yeah,
use
capital I.
No, the other one is
the eternal one should be capital. Okay, look. With little lines under them. We're not going to have to do this so much. In fact, we're about to not have to do this. Okay? In fact, if I was really deep cool, I would notice that this was integral dt, integral on a three manifold, and then this is a one form, and I could just write the rest as wedges. Would you like me to do that?
Yes.
The zero is a space-time time index?
Yes.
So how come there's an epsilon between the
zero, yeah. I'll write it the slick way, but I'll bet you're going to want me to translate it back. Okay? The slick way is this is a two-form in space-time, but I'm writing this as del zero times a one-form plus a guy called A zero times a one form A. And I'm wedging that with this two form in the spatial manifold. So now all forms in the spatial manifold sigma. Okay? And then this is minus the covariant derivative, okay, times a guy called A zero. And it's that whole thing, wedge F J times psi ij inverse. And if you want me to one time write that out the way that I was starting to, that's integral dt, integral sigma, okay, ij, if I knew more alphabets, times del 0 a I in space minus del I in space, A0 I times FJK in space, J internally psi IJ inverse. Okay? That's what the action looks like.
I think you should have it on score to zero as well.
But doesn't, no, because this is not an index, this is a time derivative. And a zero here is not a vector, it's a scalar. These three scalars labeled by the SU2 transformation. Okay? So, look. This is easy. There's pi I, which is delta S, delta A, I, so I have to have two kinds of indices, I, and the underlying ones are the spatial ones. Yeah. Now I don't understand why somebody made the suggestion to use little ABC. Should I go back and make them little ABCs? Because then I'm going to make contact with what I had before. So these are ABCs now in space. Okay.
Which ABC includes
a zero? No, it doesn't. That's the advantage of the abstract index convention. It includes whatever you need it to. This is a densitized vector field in the spatial manifold. So therefore, this index says that it's a vector field in the spatial manifold, okay, which is what a momentum field is, an electric field is. So what is it? It's delta S delta A dot. So it's all of this. What is it? It's epsilon ABC FBCJ sine inverse IJ. So that's the momentum. Okay. And then this term, I can integrate this by parts, and it's just the divergence of the momentum times A0. So the action is automatically, because here is a dot times pi, so it's automatically, there's an integral dt, an integral in the manifold, it's automatically pi ai, a dot ai, so we get the pi a dot for free, minus a zero I times the Gauss's law constraint g, where the Gauss's law constraint g is what it always is, del A pi AI. Okay? So the Hamiltonian is just the Lagrange multiplier A0I times the Gauss's law constraint. And that's it. Notice something else. Okay? Once I've expressed things in terms of the pi, the size has gone away completely. The size have gotten absorbed into the pi's. Okay. So, is that good or is that bad? This looks just like the topological field theories we studied, where the Hamiltonian is just a linear combination of constraints, and it's just the Gauss's law constraint.
So what happens to diffeomorphism
invariants? Here's a secret. Anybody see it? So we seem to have come to the wrong conclusion, that the Hamiltonian form of general relativity is just A and pi, which are conjugate to each other, and there's three constraints, which are the Gauss's law constraint, and the Hamiltonian is just proportional to the Gauss's law constraint. So there's no diffeomorphism, no nothing, no real de Witt equation, no why is this general relativity? I haven't used all the information yet.
Right.
Okay, so where have I not used all the information? So one way to say it is that the pies, there are 9 pies, because there are 3 spatial indices and 3 guys in SU2. Okay. But and the size and they absorb all the information in the size. But the size, remember, are not 9 guys, they're not a 3x3 matrix, because there are 2 constraints, they're symmetric and their trace is fixed. Okay. So in going from the size to the pies, we go from 5 guys to 9 guys. So if I trade in going from here, from this variational principle to this variational principle, I lose 4 constraints, which are these 4 constraints here. That the anti-symmetric part of psi is 0, which is 3 constraints, and then the trace is fixed, which is a 4th constraint.
Do you have to go to the S thing again? Or?
That's one way. I can go back and I can climb through the S thing. Okay. Or I can stare at the thing for a little while. Let's see if I have another board. Save them in here. Okay. Let me come back to the top board.
I mean, isn't in some sense this formalism a bit, what should I say, inconvenient? Because that implies that if I'm not able to involve psi, I cannot define psi.
Right. So there has to be, if this is going to get us anywhere, there has to be one more trick. But I promised you it was all in 4 lines, and we've already used 2 of them. I'm making up the count, but I mean, I told you it's simple. Well, so the equation is, let me just write it again, pi ai is psi inverse ij, is this right? Epsilon ABC FBC J, or assuming that I can invert the size, just tells me that FABJ, and I can invert the epsilon, is equal to epsilon ABC pi CK psi JK. Mm-hmm.
Isn't the whole secret, like, I mean, if I do that for usual young mills, that in that way I cannot construct all the pies?
Well, the point is that I couldn't possibly construct all the pies, because, I just don't have to point here. There are 9 pies and only 5 psi's. So there must be additional constraints on the pies.
Yeah.
Okay, so stare at this, okay, and find those additional constraints. Okay. Here's one. Do you give up? I told you it has to be easy. So what's the simplest thing you can make from this?
Bianchi identity for the gauge field.
Yeah, but that will go through. The Bianchi identity for the gauge field turns into the Gauss's law. Okay. So the Gauss's law is a consequence of the Bianchi identity for the gauge field. So what else can you do? That's too hard. That's too hard. I can't wait. It's really simple. We can take the F
Contracted to epsilon sigma or E.
The wisdom E, what is it? I can do lots of things, but you haven't used the simplest possible thing.
You only have psi and F to play.
I have pi.
You have pi.
Yeah. And in fact, I want to find a constraint involving pi.
And you want to fold it.
Yeah.
Contract to 1 pi, it's least 1 and 1 index.
Right, so let me contract 1 pi. Then I use this. That's epsilon A B C pi D J pi C K psi J K. Look at that. This is anti-symmetric. This takes the anti-symmetry in B and C becomes the anti-symmetry in J and K, but the anti-symmetric part of psi is zero. So there's some constraints. Okay? So we saw these before, and we called, there are three of these, and they're called D. And we'll discuss what they do in a minute. Okay? And while we're on a roll, anybody know what the next is? So that's three. We need one more. We need one, right? So
you don't know the square root, so can you use it?
Sure.
Yeah, so contract A, B, phi, phi C, F, D, plus 1, A, B, C.
Wait, how many phi's?
Just 1 phi.
Oh, no, that doesn't work. Yeah, I know what you're talking about, and that doesn't go, and that's not a constraint. That doesn't go anywhere. That doesn't get rid of this. You want something that gets rid of the sign. Yeah. So let's talk about this like adults. There, you know, it's not so hard. We want one equation per point, right? So one equation is a scalar. So it has to be a scalar on the manifold, and it has to be a scalar in SU2 in the.
Okay?
So okay, so I can take two pi's. A, I, B, J, what do I do next?
Psi, I, J.
If I put the psi, I don't get rid of the A and B. Let's try the F. F, A, B, K. Now what do I do? I can use the epsilon, epsilon, I, J, K. Okay. So now I can use this again. So this is epsilon ABC pi AI pi BJ psi, I'm sorry, pi C, and this is the K. So I have L, I have psi L, IJ L. K, and then I have an epsilon IJK. Okay, so I have that. Okay, now it takes a little staring. So we have an epsilon, we're anti-symmetric here and here. There's the K and the L, and it's anti-symmetric here and here and here. Well,
isn't it totally zero because it's.
So if you just, if you just stare at the two epsilons, the three psi's, and the two epsilon. If you stare at, here's what I want to say. Epsilon ABC, pi AI, pi BJ, epsilon ijk. Okay. Now, if I had another pi, that would be the determinant. Okay. So that has to be the inverse of pi. So let me invent a symbol which for the inverse of pi, which I'll call ECK, such that ECK pi, well, here, let me, there's another way to say this. Pi are densitized, are three densitized vector fields, so vector densities. So I can write them like frame fields, ECK, times the determinant of the frame fields. So it's a little bit implicit. If I now introduce some frame fields, such that pi being densitized is the inverse frame fields times the determinant of the frame fields, okay, then this is the determinant of the frame fields times the frame fields. So I'm calling the frame field the guys which are one forms. So the pi's are the determinant of the one form frame fields times e. Okay, I can always do this. There are three independent vector densities. I can always say there's some frame fields such that they're equal to the inverse frame fields times the determinant of the frame fields. Okay? Because there are nine of these and nine of these. So I can always do that. Then this, the two epsilons times the inverse frame fields, is the determinant of the frame fields times the frame field itself. Okay. I didn't say it quite logically, so let me say it again. Invent frame fields EAJ, and those are nine frame fields, such that when I invert them, I take the corresponding frame fields to the vector fields, multiplied by the determinant of the frame fields, I get the nine, these are now densitized vector fields, I get nine of them, and I match them to the nine here. So I can always do that. Then, this is an identity, that is, this is equal, this is the identity that says that the frame, the determinant of the frame field times the frame field is the same thing as epsilon ABC, epsilon IJK times the inverse BJECK. And this is an identity among frame fields. Check it, saturate both sides with the E upper C lower something. Okay? Once I do that, then the object here, all of this becomes EC K. This is ECL, and I get a determinant of E, and it's actually two of them. And this, by the contraction of the frame field, is E squared times delta KL. Okay? So all of that is E squared times delta KL, and this takes the trace of psi. But the trace of psi is the cosmological constant up to a factor of 3. And there's a factor of 3 that I lost somewhere in here. There's a 1 over 3. I hope, but I'm sure it's there. So then when I put all of that in, okay, all of this collapses on the E squared times the lambda. So finally, what I get is epsilon ijk, epsilon abc, Let me go back. I don't mean that. When I go back to the beginning, pi AI, pi BJ, FABK, epsilon IJK, all of that is equal to a number, which I think just comes out of lambda, times the determinant of V squared. And if you go back through the math, the determinant of V squared is actually equal to epsilon ABC, epsilon IJK, pi AI, pi BJ, pi CK. So I get 2 pi's on F is the cosmological constant times 3 pi's. And that's the constraint. So just to put it on one line, this is a constraint usually written C for the Hamiltonian constraint. And I want a little bit more blackboard because I want to rewrite that in a nice way. And then I want to summarize. So the claim is that the variational principle, which is this one, in terms of the 9 A's and the 5 psi's because of the constraints on psi, is then equivalent to a variational principle S, which is integral of pi AI, A dot AI, minus some sets of constraints. There's a constraint A0I times Gauss's law. There's a constraint, I'll call it VA times the D, which, let me write down everything as I noted. D is the covariant derivative of pi. AI is the Gauss's law. D is pi A I, sorry, B, say, FAB, I equals 0. And then there's an object I'll call N times C. And C I'm going to write as epsilon IJK, pi AI, pi BJ, times, and there are two terms, FABK, and there's another term, and don't trust me for the sign, plus lambda epsilon ABC pi CK. Putting the two terms together. And if you remember, we had this system of constraints the second class.
You want to put the epsilon outside the back? That's not everything.
Here?
Yeah.
No. Because this AB ties up these two and ties these two here. So the claim is that these two variational principles are equivalent. This is what I thought I got. But I have to add 4 constraints, so I add 4 constraints with 4 Lagrange multipliers. One is a vector field, and one is a scalar. If I want to worry about density weights, notice that C is actually density weight 2, because the pi's are each a density weight, F is weightless, pi is a density weight, but epsilon lower is an inverse density. So this is actually a density weight 2. So to integrate a density weight 2 object, the Lagrange multiplier needs to be a density weight minus 1 object. but why not? Okay. So, the claim is that this variation principle is the same as this variation principle, and we've gone through something like 6 blackboards to get to that variation principle from the Einstein's Hilbert action, or 8 blackboards or something like that. So the claim is that this variation principle is equivalent to the Einstein-Hilbert action. So what I've done is a proof, although it's probably possibly not the most convincing proof. So I will reassure you that there are more direct proofs to go from the Einstein equations to here. But this is the one involving the least calculation, I know.
This is always the way to implement constraints. You note them and then you put them in by hand, like, as dimension multipliers.
Sure.
It is
sure. Because, I mean, in the variational principle, constraints have to be implemented by some variation, so you have to introduce a Lagrange multiplier. Now, the claim is that if you start with the, if you go way, way back and you go back to the Plobansky equation, the equation, Plobansky action, you can turn by turn, the Plobansky action into this, without going through all these variation principles and redefinitions. But that's a lot more work.
So it is there, from this stuff.
It is behind it, yes. It is there. And I...
So there is this assumption here as well. You have to go through this psi and you have to invert it, so...
Yes, sure.
It's going to prove this, but you don't need that. Because otherwise it's not really...
Well, no, the invertibility of psi, if we go back, the invertibility of psi tells you that from the pi's you can get the s. Okay. And so that's a kind of generic condition. That is, it says the fact that you can get, think now of the pi's. Here's a way to think of that equation. If I look at the equation I'm pointing to, okay, let me write it this way. Epsilon ABC, FBC I. So that's some vector density. Let me call that B, because that sort of reminds us of the magnetic fields. Okay, those are 3 vector densities which have the left-hand curvature in them, okay, which are sort of like, they're exactly like magnetic fields. And it says that these magnetic fields are given by psi ik, times the pi's, and the pi's you can think of as being like electric fields, because the conjugate momentum to gauge fields are electric fields. But the pi's are also, through what we went through there, the pi's are related to some set of frame fields. So we can write this as psi ik times the determinant of E times some frame fields, DAK. And now let's stare at that. It says that these magnetic fields are given by some coefficients, I coefficients, psi IK, times the determinant of the frame fields, times the inverse frame field, DAK. Okay. Now, the frame fields, by the equivalence principle, you can always go into a freely falling frame, and the frame fields just become, you can choose them to be, you know, frame fields of some freely falling frame, some orthonormal frame. Okay. So this is just, says that the 9 magnetic fields, which are the magnetic parts of the self-dual part of the curvature tensor, are expressed in a frame field basis in terms of 5 coefficients, which are the size. Okay, which is the This is the pullback to the spatial manifold of this equation here, written in terms of two forms. And in fact, let me make it explicit, that there's a lot of stuff to explain. These sigmas are two forms on space-time. If I take a sigma, if I have, where's my picture here? If I have a three surface embedded in space-time, I can take sigma, which is a two form in space-time, and I can pull it back to a two form in sigma. Oh, this is very confusing, because I call Vladi Freeman sigma in the three manifold. Okay, forms pull back. So given a two form on space-time, I get a two form in the spatial manifold. But if I have a two form in the spatial manifold, I can dualize it and write it as a vector density. So I can write sigma AB, epsilon ABC, and that's a vector density. So given a two form in space-time, I get a two form in the spatial manifold, and dualizing, I get a vector density in the spatial manifold, which is the pis. And I do that for each of the three two forms. So if you go back to everything we said, the pis are the two forms pulled back to the spatial manifold. Okay. But if you go back to who these were the self-dual part of E wedge E. And the self-dual part of E wedge E has a part that goes E0 wedge E space. Okay. So if I take pi 1, that's sigma 2, 3. But sigma 2, 3 goes like sigma 0, it goes like E0 wedge E1 plus E2 wedge E3. Okay. The E0 pulled back to the spatial manifold is 0. So the pi is like E2 wedge E3. And that's exactly that equation somewhere up there where I took the pi. That's that equation there. So that's the inverse of that equation. Okay. So the pis are several things at the same time. The pis are the self-dual two-form sigma pulled back into the three-manifold. They're also epsilon ijk, ej wedge ek in terms of the frame fields.
And now I'm a bit confused. Where do I see from this definition that they are not everywhere in finite
element? I haven't gotten to that yet. Okay. Now, if you have a non-degenerate metric, so the determinant of the metric is always not zero, then you can always find frame fields and dual frame fields. And finding frame fields and dual frame fields, you can always express some vector fields in terms of the frame fields. And the size are the coefficients of expressing the vector fields, which are these b's, which are the magnetic part of the self-dual part of the curvature, in terms of the frame fields. So the size of the coefficients will tell you how to do that. So when the metric is non-degenerate, the size exists, the b's exist. Then you can plug everything through and find that the constraints are satisfied as a result of the size being symmetric and your trace being fixed in terms of the cosmological constant. And then you can plug further and get a solution of the Einstein equations. When the metric is degenerate, when the determinant of the metric is zero or infinite, okay, then you can't necessarily follow this train of thought. then this may break down because, if you like, there are now not enough E's to express any B's. And in general, all the machinations, some of the machinations that I did there, in which I had to solve the constraints to assume that these were invertible to break down. So the relationship between these constraints and this variational principle only works in the case that the determinant of the E's is not zero. Otherwise, going from here to there breaks down somewhere. So a way to say it is that this variational principle, basically this is true of every, we've discussed something like 6 different variational principles. And I've made a hand-waving argument that they're equal to each other. And basically, what really is happening is that I'm just getting embarrassed with this stuff. What's really happening is that there's a solution, there are different solution sets for these different variational principles. And I won't draw them all, but the area on which they agree is where the metric or the frame fields have non-vanishing determinant. In which case you can make all of these things go everywhere. But each variation principle I define is, because they're polynomial in the E's, or things that substitute for the E's, has the domain of validity which goes outside this, and then they disagree.
So if E's are not invertible, then it's not really a space-time theory, because you get no nice Gini mu from it.
Well, you can get a Gini mu which is not invertible, which is not has does not have vanishing does not have non-vanishing determinant.
Yeah, well, what I'm saying is that the components will not be independent of being.
Yeah.
But is this like some points, isolated points, or that's it's easy to have for the three one singularity, for instance.
Well, so the kind of things that you want to show amongst all these different pairs is that if you start with initial data where the metric is non-degenerate and therefore there's an equivalence in the initial data, because this is all constraint equations, so there's equivalence among initial data, and you evolve that the evolutions are equivalent for as long as they remain non-singular. Of course, the Einstein equations have singularity, so things can break down, but you can show among various of these, and I haven't worked in all the details, but certainly I know, say, between the Astrakhar formulation and the Einstein equations, if you start off with initial data which is non-singular, the evolution equations preserve the correspondence between the Einstein equations. Those there are called the Astrakhar, or the Astrakhar-Sen equations. These here. Roughly speaking, these were argued for by Sen, this is Amitabha Sen, in a paper about supergravity, and then derived by Abhay Ashtekar. And the way that Abhay did it the first time is he took the ABM formalism, and he actually made a canonical transformation in the ABM formalism, which
did you
put this on
the notation?
I'm sure I did.
What?
Yeah,
he has the same D for
square root
derivative and
this is a regular D and this is a script D. Thank you.
They must be only reactive. Try to derive all
this canonical transformation. I did the yes. Well, because he had Amitabha Sen's paper. Amitabha Sen, I mean, the Einstein equations are consistency equations for the Stein-Friedhelm equation. Mm-hmm. And using that, Amitabha Sen basically guessed these. A guess is too weak. He showed that in terms of the left-handed part, he showed that only the left-handed part of the connection comes into the spin-free-half equations. And then he showed that when you expressed it like that, the consistency conditions that you got by consistency of the spin-three-halves equation were the Einstein equations. When he did it in sort of a Hamiltonian picture, were the Einstein equations in some form like this. And he said, wow, they're polynomial. And that was 1982. And a bunch, I mean, a lot of people noticed that and scratched their heads and thought that's really, that must be important for something. And then by using that as inspiration, plus some other things he was doing involving twister theory, really managed to turn a very long crank starting from the ADM formalism and doing canonical transformation to these. And it was very impressive, and it was, the check was pages and pages and pages and pages. And then basically these different action principles were, I mean, there was sort of an obvious thing that you should probably try doing the change of variables to level the action principle rather than. So I forget which is some form of the action principle where you could split into left and right hand parts, Ted and I did. And we were actually, we did it, we wanted to extend the formalism to supergravity and back to match what Sandman had. So we went back to the action principle and we found this splitting and that we only needed half the equations, half the action principle. Then Ted did supergravity, the rest of supergravity, and then Ted got together with these other collaborators and began rediscovering this stuff, and one after the other. And then you know, Klebanski wrote to them and said, you know, I wrote a paper in 1968 which has every equation, every important equation in your paper, which was true.
I remember for a while people said those polynomials were very nice, but it was this reality condition.
Yeah, so so far everything I've said is pretty. Right.
But why didn't we encounter this problem with being not able to define the momentum everywhere on manifold before? I mean, like in all the series we considered before, we never had this problem in constructing our conjugate momentum.
Sure.
So how does this come in? What is now so different?
So, I mean, had we taken, I don't know what's left on the board, but had we taken, say, that form of the action principle up there, E wedge, E wedge, F, okay, and done the 3 plus 1 and Hamiltonian description from there, okay. Which is what we did originally with Ted. And it was also done by Joseph Samuels at the same time. It's many more steps that you get eventually to the same place, but with fewer assumptions.
But your conjugate momentum is still not everywhere.
Well, no, you just get directly the conjugate momentum to A is related to E wedge G.
Yeah.
So you get that directly with nothing implicit. And there's no conjugate momentum for E, and then that gives you some constraints, and you have to do a lot, and you have to eliminate a lot of variables in terms of other variables to get down from the 16 E's to eventually the 9 pi's. And so, I mean, I can do it, but let me also, I didn't finish discussing the thing about degeneracy. Let me mention the converse. Because the converse is definitely true, that is, there are solutions of these equations for which the determinant of the metric is zero, which are not solutions of Einstein's equations. They have good evolution. Since the Hamiltonian, so this is the Hamiltonian here, since the Hamiltonian is polynomial, the equators of motion are polynomial, the equators of motion don't require that the metric have non-vanishing determinants. So the equations of motion you get from here, we'll write them down probably next time, continue to exist even when the metric becomes degenerate. But they're no longer equivalent to the Einstein equations because the Einstein equations don't exist when the metric becomes degenerate. Yeah?
Some philosophical find, perhaps. when do I say that two classical theories are the same? I mean, presumably their solution sets are identical.
Right, and if they're not, they're not.
If they're not.
That's a very good question. And as a philosophical, but okay, there's a good thing and a bad thing. Okay? And the good thing is, so let's just take this theory and Einstein's theory. This theory and Einstein's theory have solution sets that overlap. Actually, I think it's more like every solution to Einstein's equations, because they're non-degenerate, is within this larger space.
That's
okay. Okay. And these are degenerate here. Okay. Now, the extension to here. And this, by the way, is not only true of the Ashtakar form, it's true of the Palatinian form we started with to begin with, when we just wrote the action as E wedge, E wedge, R. It's already true. Okay. This form, by being polynomial, one can make progress with quantizing both the Pathfinder language and the Hamiltonian language. Okay. Why has one made progress? One has made progress because a very nonlinear constraint has been dropped. That very nonlinear constraint is the constraint to the determinant of GAB is not zero. And this has been dropped. When this is present, the configuration space is not a linear space. There's no linear structure because this is some quartic equation, some quartic surface is excluded in the phase of configuration. When this is dropped, the equations of motion in the Hamiltonian formalism becomes polynomial, and you can make progress quantizing, but you drop this. Now, is this physically significant? Well, you're allowed to say the following. You're allowed to say, okay, the two equations are different, but assuming that I can couple this one to matter, I could just say that Einstein was wrong and the theory of the world classically is this one, and not this one. There are several buts. One but is that, does this theory have all the nice properties of this theory? For example, does this theory have a positive energy theorem? Okay. And the answer is no. This theory does not have a positive energy theorem. Okay. There are configurations, you can write down solutions to the constraints of the equations of motion. This was discovered by Madhavan Wirawich, Madhavan Wijiwad. Oh my God. It's one of these long Sri Lankan names.
So the Hamiltonian is not bound.
Yes, the Hamiltonian, if you make asymptotically flat boundary conditions, but you allow the metric, the determinant of the metric to vanish, you can construct initial data, which in the neighborhood of spatial, let me just call that spatial infinity, so in the neighborhood of spatial infinity look like Schwarzschild. Okay. Then there's some shell where the determinant of the metric is equal to zero, and then there's flat. This is, I don't remember how to spell his name, Wijiwadana.
That's the question I was asking. It's not just in some isolated points, determinant of G0. You're talking about actually reaching.
Yes. 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 So there are such solutions to the Einstein's equations, to these equations.
Yeah.
Okay. And this is Schwarzschild for any m. And the positive energy theorem doesn't work because the positive energy theorem, whichever version you use, solves an elliptic equation through the whole spatial manifold that breaks down when the determinative metric is zero.
It's actually Birkhoff's theorem that collapses as well.
Yes, so Birkhoff's theorem collapses, and okay, so it's bad.
So
why is it bad? Cannot ask.
What?
Why is it bad necessarily?
Well, I
mean, there are also solutions based of general relativity of also standard formulation contained in the theory. So in that sense, it's good.
Well, okay, so here's a point of view, okay? Because now there are two distinct points. There are two issues, and I think it depends, and this is sort of programmatic. It's, I don't know about philosophical, but programmatic, but it's worth spending to say, what problem are we trying to solve? Okay. If the problem you're trying to solve is the Homer problem, if that's not too pejorative, apply some method of quantization to some version of the Einstein equations. Okay. One, not here today, but one eventually makes a lot of progress on that. Okay. But based on having dropped this condition. So that's just true. It may be good, it may be bad. Somebody could say, you know, I mean, Chris Isham used to write long, long papers about the implications of this condition for the quantum theory and how it enforced nonlinearity of a certain kind, and he had a way of approaching this through having a group action on the space of solutions. Okay. And Chris could say, well, you haven't solved the problem I wanted to solve. I mean, he was nice enough not to say that at the time, but that's just because he's nice. And, you know, that's just true. You've made progress on a quantizing a version of the Einstein equations. There are a lot of things to say in its favor, with matter, if you want it, with supersymmetry, if you want it, with all the solutions of Einstein equations you introduce, but some other solutions. Which in a sense is not surprising, because so somebody can come back on the other side and say, you know, come on, who are you kidding? Okay. When you make a quantum field theory, the path integral measure has support, okay, on all the worst kind of paths, non-differentiable, non-this, non-that path. That path integral always has support on if you want to make a quantum theory, you're going to have to give up things like this that look very classical. You're going to have to give up anything that depends on smoothness, differentiability, and so forth. So what do you care? You want to just get a good path integral measure that you can fight.
Oh, well, that's not completely fair, because in principle, I would not need a path integral
measure. Well, but I can say the same thing for the Hamiltonian theory. Okay. Yeah.
Maybe rewording the same thing. I mean, you have to distinguish between the space of configurations versus the space of solutions.
Yeah.
When it's space of configurations, you gain anything.
Right.
Yeah.
The space of solutions is something that I don't think you can say.
So I have to guess that, I mean, so if the Hamiltonian is not bounded below, you couple this to the electric field, which just pushes bounded from below, then from just the reasons we look at configuration space or phase space, there would be much, much more microstates available if you just...
Yes, sure. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's nothing that would prevent something happening like that. And then...
I'm going to give a but, and then I'm going to give a big but. Okay. One is, I didn't really draw this correctly, okay, that is, every point in here is infinitesimally close to a point in here, because points in here are points that satisfy the equation determinant of E equals zero, and I can just move infinitesimally in any direction and make the determinant of E non-zero, and I'm here. So this is more like a shell of lower measure around this.
So it's dense, the classical solution space is dense.
Yes. Okay. And one can make sense of that. But finally, I mean, I'll just tell you my attitude for what it's worth. My attitude is, I think if all this is interesting and useful noting, and I'm going to spend a lot more time on his formalism. But ultimately, I don't think the most interesting question is the Homer problem of quantizing the Einstein equations, because I accept the general point of view which comes from the renormalization group and effective field theory that the Einstein equations are most likely the low energy effective description of something more fundamental. So I see this as a tool to uncover a language to discuss that more fundamental theory or more fundamental class of theories.
Even classier.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what you're saying, essentially. You're saying even classier.
If you, I've made the worst case deliberately here, okay, but I'm willing to extend into a set of lower measure. That if I'm, again, if I'm thinking about a path integral, okay, I can integrate right through these things. Right? I mean, I'm, you know, they're lower measure, and I'm willing to extend the configuration space a little bit into a configuration space of lower measure to get a path integral measure, to get an inner product that I can manipulate and try to develop tests. Okay. So on the one hand, I can justify it. On the other hand, okay, the absence of a positive energy theorem, even if it just applies to a little shell around the Einstein equations, is something that does keep me up nights sometimes.
So I mean, because it's just a lower dimensional shell, I mean, there would probably won't be any stability problem. That was your answer, right?
Yes.
So
classically.
Yeah, classically.
Well, and classically, there's no instability. And classically, if you start again with initial data in fear, you always stay in fear.
Yeah.
Until you hit a singularity, and then it doesn't matter.
I mean, that's a nice answer, right? You may have failures on the shell, and I mean, the normal reason for saying that instability is just reasons for entropy reasons. It's much more
space-based
points.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in some sense, the point is
he just breaks down.
That the point is that there aren't as many solutions here as you think there are, because once you go to some place where the determinant metric is zero, there's no gravitons that live there, and so there's this. It looks like there are more spherically symmetric solutions because you lose Birkhoff's theorem, but in terms of generic solutions, there are many less. Yeah.
So it's possible that there's some quantum theory, and somehow these quote unquote unphysical solutions go away in the quantum theory.
It's possible. Yes.
Is that what it, I mean, is the belief that there's one quantum theory?
That's not my belief, but that is some people's belief.
So is he believe?
Do you want to repeat?
Yes.
That it's in general possible that whatever classical theory you start with to write down the quantum mechanics, once you write down the quantum mechanics, it doesn't have to admit all the classical solutions.
Sure.
So it's possible that there's one unique quantum theory in quantum mechanics.
Yes.
Which has some limit, which will pick up the natural low energy effect of action by itself. So I don't have to worry about what the classical theory really is provided. Or I believe I have an argument to say that there's a unique
quantum right. So there is a unique Hilbert space of states, and we'll be studying it. In that unique Hilbert space of states, certainly the condition, this condition is there generically, that is, you have to pick a very, very artificial special state to get the expectation value of the determinant of the metric to be zero. They're there, but you can then talk about their measure and the inner product and so forth. And once you go to the, let's get there and then we can talk about it. Okay. So because what this translates to in a diffeomorphism of brain language, the observable you can measure is the volume of space, the volume of a station manifold. Okay. And then you can discuss the there is a degenerate sector where this is zero, and there is a non-degenerate sector. And let's come back to that when we know enough to talk about. And I think that that's the best thing to do. The uniqueness results are kinematical, that is, they're up to the space of diffeomorphism in various states. I don't think that their uniqueness results dynamically, which is one reason I believe that the dynamics which have come from the Einstein equations is probably not special from the quantum mechanical point of view. But let's wait till we get there. And
just a question.
Yeah.
Has anyone actually explored the equivalent of that scenario, a completely crazy shell and stuff, in the case of Friedman?
No, it can't. I mean, the Friedman is homogeneous.
Yeah, but in time, at some point, A goes to zero, the determinant is zero.
No, because again, if you match initial data to the Einstein equations, you stay within the solution to the Einstein equations.
No, but the question is supposed to start from zero.
No. There is a space of cosmological solutions where the determinant metric is always zero, and was always zero, and will always be zero.
So you can have it get out of
it. Yeah, if you start there, you stay there. And if you're homogeneous, the determinant metric is zero everywhere.
But mechanically, you know, from one to the other.
I don't know. That's a good question. But there is a little space of solutions, of cosmological solutions, where the determinant metric is always zero.
So the reason we're looking at something like, you know, it's basically Minkowski, when it goes zero, then it goes pretty much in time.
I don't think so. No.
It's not possible.
In fact, what you just said is not possible.
The quantum mechanics is something fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I have to come back to the energy problem here.
Sure.
So, if you take Klein-Gödel, for example, you realize that the classical field equation doesn't have a bound with the Hamiltonian, but then if you turn pi to operators, then the quantum spectrum is bound from below because you have an annihilation equation. Is it simpler here then that this boundness will go away?
When you keep quantizing.
Yeah, when you quantize.
That's a conjecture.
Okay.
It's something actually with Artem we spent some time on and other people have spent time on. There's what, since we know what the Hilbert space is, it would be nice to either prove or find counterexamples to the conjecture that there is a quantum positive energy here. That is that with appropriate boundary conditions, the Hamiltonian is zero for space should come back, but with appropriate boundary conditions, the Hamiltonian is a surface term. And can you construct from that surface term a quantum mechanical Hamiltonian, which is positive definite in the Hilbert space? And
but also for the Dipolar field, that's not natural. It's a case when you have to invent normal order.
Sure.
So it's not like you write down the theory and you apply some normalization.
But morally, I mean, normal ordering is a pretty weak assumption.
No problem.
So, but in any case, the situation is that does not exist. What should I say? Anybody who proves that result gets an A in this class for 15 minutes. that's a very important.
Should be 10 years.
Yeah, well, roughly speaking, yes. No, that would be a very important result. And more generally, you know, people who are doing projects, anybody who wants to try to pick up the pieces where Artem and I left them is welcome to. I mean, I think we have a very specific conjecture, which is a sort of quantum version of Witten's proof of positive energy, and it requires proving the existence of a certain operator equation, of solutions to a certain, proving that a certain operator equation has solutions, and we were not able to do it, but my guess is, I'm optimistic, so my guess is that it does. But anyway, that's the state of the art. There is a paper by Thomas in which he finds a form of the boundary term which is positive definite on space of asymptotically flat solutions. But for various reasons, I don't think that that's the right Hamiltonian. But in case anybody looks in the literature, there is that in the literature. But it's sort of too nice. In the sense, in the particular sense, it's positive definite also off the constraint surface. And that's too much. that you want the energy to be positive definite when the constraints are satisfied. A form of the energy which is positive definite also off the constraint surface is not something which exists in the classical theory, to my knowledge. And so I think it's too cheap to get it in the quantum theory.
So how do you get out of ghosts in the sense of negative norms as well? Because I'm only one thing, those are the other negative energy states and negative norms.
But the perturbative, that's the limit for harmonic oscillator, like it's just, I mean, we will get to the, there is a inner product, and the inner product is positive definite, thank God. Okay. I think this was a good place to stop. Any other questions? Okay, so let me just say what's coming. And by the way, thanks for the off time. We will now go back to regular schedule, etc. And I hope people go to see, if you want to, go to see DC Randall online. From now on, the next class, what we have to do is study the system of constraints. Figure out whether they're first class or second class or business class, if you remember those denominations. Figure out what their algebra is, figure out what they generate, and then understand what the equations of motion are and how the equations of motion are related to the Einsteinian state. So there's, now that we have this, there's a lot of work to do at the classical level, which I hope we can squeeze into one class, and then we will start with the quantization. That's what we're doing.
We also have a calculator,
I think. The algebra, yeah. Yeah. And we will. It's, since it's polynomial, it's, and you know, if you want to, I've said this before, but if you ever want to be convinced of the beauty of this, just compute the algebra of the ADM constraints. And then come back and compute the algebra of these. The algebra of these is simple and polynomial, and if you just think about what they, if you just count, you know, density, basically if you just count density weights and who is a what kind of thing, and you guess what the algebra has to be to close, you're right. So, and so, but we'll do that. Okay.